Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I had the pleasure of saying today that the Barnes Review is finishing up my book. I think it's my ninth or something. On the Soviet Union. And it will be available, I'm thinking, the end of next month, the latest. And we'll be able to be, you could purchase it from the Barnes Review directly, which is what I suggest you do. And Paul Angel, I want to thank him because this is the third book he's done for me, and he's an extraordinary graphic designer, and he has made my books look tremendous. And so supporting the Barnes Review, of course, is always great. Willis Cardo, who founded the Barnes Review and of course the Spotlight, American Free Press, that gave me my start back when I finished my dissertation in 1999. Quite frankly, I wouldn't really be anything without him. He was my second education. He took a chance on me. Really, it was actually Michael Collins Piper who brought me to his attention, and I became a part of the Barnes Review organization, and they went bankrupt twice. I lost my job there in 2004, but that certainly was nobody's fault. And I became a professor at Mount St. Mary's after that, and so we were always on very good terms. And presently, I'm their senior researcher, so I review papers and things like that, and I'm always involved in it. And they're a trustworthy group, as far as these guys go. Anyway, that being said, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of this show, and we'll talk about that some other time, but it's been a tremendous amount of work, and one of the things that stands out here is my concern with Russian literature. In most societies, the Russian in particular, but in most societies, you really can't understand what they're about unless you read their stories. And in these stories, they tell you what they consider important. Now, in mass media, it doesn't matter because it's what the regime thinks is important. But when you go deeper than that, when you're talking about legitimately popular people who actually speak for the core of the nation, Alexander Solzhenitsyn is absolutely essential as a dissident from the Soviet Empire. In my upcoming book, of course, there's a chapter on Solzhenitsyn, on one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich. But I want to go further than that today. Solzhenitsyn is often quoted but rarely understood. His approach to both literature and political philosophy, which for him really were one and the same, in Russia, I think more than anywhere else, literature is intensely political and historical. And of course, also a layman amongst the old believers in the Russian Orthodox Church, and has said over and over again that there is no such thing as a Russian who is not a member of the Church. A member of the Church of Russia is a Russian, and that it's not necessarily an ethnic category. It's a civilizational one. You see that with Dostoevsky and Dugin and so many other people have made this claim. Of course, there's an ethnic side to it, but that's only one aspect of it. It's larger than that. It's a civilization. And despite the fact that the Gulag Archipelago occasionally is cited, not so much anymore, the context of that book is now long gone. But his political theory is not widely known. You see, people who, I said this the last time, people trained in literary criticism aren't well-versed in philosophical or historical issues. And they're not necessarily experts on Russian history. And even if they were, they'd be coming out of the American or British institutions, which, you'd rather be ignorant then come from these people. But, you know, people in departments of literature are not experts on the USSR, but they think they could read Solzhenitsyn, which is a very difficult thing. You have to know in depth what the Soviet Union was before you begin reading him. And then, of course, what Orthodoxy is and what old Russia was. And, of course, Solzhenitsyn was a defender of that, which, despite his Nobel Prize, has been overwhelmingly rejected and held in contempt by the Western, you know, dons of literature departments and universities. So I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about, you know, when I talked about Dostoevsky, we talked about three major works. Here I want to do the same. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, and then two others that don't get talked about very much. The English language versions of these all came out in the 60s. The Cantor Ward and The First Circle. These are difficult books. One Day, of course, is much shorter. These other two are anything but that. They're extremely complicated. They're very long. And Solzhenitsyn is assuming that his reader knows quite a bit. The reception of these works has been hostile, overwhelmingly. I think I've mentioned before that President Gerald Ford refused to meet with Solzhenitsyn because this was a time of détente, and he didn't want to irritate Brezhnev. But there's one concept. It's pretty rare that you could reduce a man and his work to a concept. In this case, I think you can, although it's very, very broad. And that is the dialectic between, you know, human free will, that is our conscience, and what informs it on the one hand, and power on the other. We talked about this with Vasil Stus a few weeks ago. When you talk about power with the state, what Solzhenitsyn has in mind isn't any other, just any old course of power. He's talking about the modern enlightenment-based state. Because you really can't talk about a state prior to the Enlightenment. You had different kinds of social and political authorities, but to refer to a state in the High Middle Ages is an error. We use the term just for the sake of conversation, but conceptually speaking, it's what we call the state in the modern era doesn't have much relation to a state in the ancient world or in the medieval world. In the modern world, you know, and this show has centered on the criticism of modernity. My doctoral dissertation was on Michael Oakeshott's criticism of modernity. This has been my whole world. And what it comes down to is that the modern world prides itself on reason, but it doesn't understand it. It uses it as an instrument rather than as an object. And in fact, there's nothing less rational than the modern world and, of course, the postmodern world. Now, objective reason, which is not an Enlightenment idea, is the immanence of rational concepts within the natural order itself. Human beings are not rational, but the natural order is. That is exactly what the Enlightenment rejects. The ancient, medieval, patristic idea that the natural order contains reason, it contains logos. It's a mark of its creation. Secularism and the instrumental concept of reason destroyed this completely. What you have instead is subjective reason, instrumental reason. The Enlightenment idea starts with the notion that you have a human brain, really the elite brain. They kind of reject the idea of a mind, so it's a brain that abstractly confronts an irrational and hostile universe. This is the central beginning of Karl Marx, but also of Thomas Hobbes and most of the early Enlightenment. The brain itself is the sole locus of reason. Modernity has removed all rational content from the world itself. The world is dead. It's just dead matter. So this creates a ruling class whose interest is served by imposing a technological grid on nature, the external world, creating their own nature in place of the old. So the old medieval Christian view of logos is called superstition. And this new order, the Promethean order, saw nature as hostile and in desperate need of being replaced, needs to be fixed. So it reduces reason to a blunt instrument. There's no content to it. It's just a conceptual apparatus, and it could be used on anything. It could take its content from anywhere. That means anything can be controlled. Reason is no longer autonomous. It's an instrument. So it can be harnessed by something. And of course, today it's harnessed by capitalism and production, as in the Soviet Union was harnessed to production and socialism. I should say Marxism, Leninism. But in both cases, and the USSR and USA had far more in common than they had difference. But reason in both societies exists solely for the sake of dominating everything that comes before it. Ideas are considered commodities. Even language is just one tool among others. So it's a product. The common ideology of both socialism and capitalism, they're really two sister worldviews. Solzhenitsyn spent a lot of time saying that they are very similar. And in his speeches, you know, critical of the Soviet Union, of course, he was also criticizing the U.S. Modernity was never about liberation. Modernity was about reducing the entire planet to one large factory, as Lenin advocated. They start with One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Solzhenitsyn's second most famous book. Very brief, very easy to read. But he's talking about a day in the life of Ivan Denisovich Shukov in the Gulag system, the corrective labor camp system in the former USSR. And, of course, the whole concept of freedom of conscience, or freedom and conscience, has to do with man's relationship to God. And whether it be a prison, the state itself, or, as we'll see a bit later, the cancer ward in the hospital. That's where power is manifest. Now, the background here is that, like Solzhenitsyn himself, Ivan was imprisoned in the Gulag because he was taken as a POW by the Germans in World War II. That was sufficient to get sent to a corrective labor camp. Just by being exposed to the camps was enough to make you unreliable. So you didn't actually do anything. The very fact that you were there means you had to go to a camp for a while. So that's something that this fictional character and, of course, Solzhenitsyn himself have in common. The camps themselves, many of them were in very harsh climates and were done extremely intense labor with minimal nourishment. And the book opens where Ivan awakes quite ill. He's not on time for his work detail, so he has to clean the guards' quarters and by punishment. He's concerned primarily with his food ration, which, depending on the economy, gets smaller and smaller over time. It's very small here, but because of the conditions of the place, it becomes due to the sole locus of everything that people do and think about. It becomes an obsession with food. It's really mostly disgusting and almost inedible, but when you're starving, you'll eat anything. But the issues of belief and truth emerge in stark relief in a prison system or in a hospital. It's not difficult to understand. We've been talking about that a lot on this show over the last decade. When you are imprisoned, when you are placed in an extremely hostile world, when you have nothing, when you've been reduced to absolutely an inhuman creature, you could do one of two things. Either you could obsess about your stomach, getting the most out of your ration and nothing else, just surviving. Or you could focus on God and the Spirit and what actual happiness consists in. You only have those two options. You have absolutely nothing else. The detail here, the work detail, is a unit. And the way that the Gulag worked is on the principle of collective punishment. So when a project is left undone or accomplished very badly, the entire unit is punished, even when it's clear that it's one person who's at fault. And the positive part of this is that labor was thought of as something that was rationally allocated to each member, so that each one has to do his share. So punishing the whole unit regardless of, you know, may just be one or two people, forces each member to watch every other one. It's a form of coercion, but it's also a means of generating cooperation. Now, our relationship to God only becomes an issue in the second half of the novel. There's a foreman of the work detail. Ivan is making fun of him. And, of course, the man is an atheist, and he calls believers savages and stupid and all that. And he says, well, I can't believe in God because God cannot be seen. I only believe what I can see. And he notes that, you know, when the moon is new, of course, it can't be seen either. They don't really know it's there. He's making fun of him here. There's a serious point here, though. And all the banter that you see in Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn, all perception, no matter what it is based on a certain kind of faith. And the word faith has been so mangled and redefined over the last 100 years. In this case, we're talking about blind faith. Now, that's not what the word means. But a leap of faith, in this case. There is no proof and no way to prove in any modern system of logic that what our senses report is actually there. It's just as easy to say that it's what our brains are telling us rather than what's actually out there. Or even that we're brains in a jar being controlled by some sinister power. Alyosha is the prisoner that is a Protestant. And he is where the locus of the issue of God. And his primary quality is that he argues that he becomes a better prisoner because of his faith in God. And he hides a handwritten New Testament. And this is what keeps him resilient in the face of death, which pretty much is all coming to all of them. He does favors for others without expecting anything in return. And in a camp like this, which brutalizes everybody, he stands out. The handwritten Bible that he has is very easy to hide. He keeps it in a crack in the wall near his bunk, and he knows what will happen to him if it'll be found. And Ivan says, "Thanks be to thee, O God, another day is over." Upon hearing this, he says to Ivan, "There you are, Ivan Denisovich. Your soul is asking to be allowed to pray to God. Why not let it have its way?" Ivan says, "Because, Alyosha, prayers are like petitions. If they don't get through at all, or it's completely rejected." Then Alyosha says, "That's because you've never prayed long enough or fervently enough. That's why your prayers aren't answered. It has to be persistent. If you have faith and say to a mountain, make way, it'll make way." And Ivan says, "Don't talk rot. I've never seen mountains going anywhere. Come to think of it, I've never seen any mountains. But when will you and your whole Baptist club, and all that praying in the Caucasus, did one single mountain ever move?" Then Alyosha says this: "We didn't pray for anything like that. The Lord's behest was that we should pray for no earthly or transient thing except our daily bread. Give us this day our daily bread. We shouldn't pray for somebody to send us a parcel of something or extra portion of food. What people prize highly is vile in the sight of God. We must pray for spiritual things, asking God to remove the scum of evil from our hearts." And Ivan relates a story about a priest in the parish of Polonia. Apparently was the wealthiest man in the region. And the priest had to pay alimony for at least 3 women that he had been married to before. He was living with his 4th family. And the author narrates, "Poor devils, what harm does their praying do to anybody? Collected 25 years all around, that's how things are nowadays. 25 is the only kind of sentence they hand out." Now, this aside from Solzhenitsyn, as a narrator, furthers the idea of the book. The camp system rescues man from the insanity of war and materialism. It does it through the total dehumanization of the person. Again, when one has nothing, you either die or return to God. Like in Dostoevsky, prison can do great things for you. Then Ivan says, God isn't really the problem here. What he refuses to believe in is the afterlife based on rewards and punishments. And the Baptist prisoner switches his theme to the nature of freedom. He states that being imprisoned is not really a bad thing, especially since one can have the time to search one's soul that you wouldn't have in a daily grind elsewhere. Apart from the world and his daily cares, the prisoner can focus on what little he has. It forces the poor, tortured soul to attach itself to God since nothing else remains. That's the point of the book. Solzhenitsyn narrates, Alyosha wasn't lying, though. You could tell from his voice and his eyes that he was glad to be in prison. It's because that's where his soul is exposed. With no physical pleasures, he has nothing else. It's really the thesis of the novel. The problem is, the outside world is far more of a prison than the gulag is. Because outside, you're living this daily grind of constant struggle and constant worry. And whatever freedom you think you have evaporates pretty quickly as you're trying to climb some institutional ladder or impress somebody or pay debts or whatever it is. The camp is far simpler. It's about survival. You're cut off from even the tiniest forms of freedom, but show themselves in the urban world. The camp also holds out the promise of death, often violent and painful. And this is what forced people, for the first time in many cases, to look at their souls. So the essential truth here is that this handwritten New Testament that he kept in the wall is the most effective means of keeping some dignity in prison. That regardless of the materialist ideology of the USSR, the origin of the gulag, God still exists. He cares for man, he sees human beings as his own, whatever. Dignity is impossible under materialism, whether it be Western or Eastern, because it only sees human beings as chunks of matter, bundles of nerve endings. One is as good as another. There's nothing particularly moral about one coming into existence or going out of existence. It's just some kind of a mysterious spark animating a hunk of flesh and having no moral content than that. So we see it in Dostoevsky, Stus, and now in Solzhenitsyn. The camp is humanity exposed under extreme conditions. Only there is the soul forced to make peace with its own coming death. Ivan Denisovitz himself is not really an atheist. He seems to, I don't know, maintain this kind of folk religion, no real clerical thing. Unlike Tolstoy and the Cossacks. The scriptures, even though still are kind of an institutional form of religion since it's written down. So Ivan represents the demoralized human being under this system. And it doesn't matter whether it's communist or capitalist, they're all materialist systems. They create this overworked, cynical type that's been beaten down to the point where he can only believe in what he can see or hear. Not because he really believes that, but because he doesn't have the strength for anything else. He doesn't have the conceptual tool for anything else. There's also Solzhenitsyn being a strict Orthodox man using a Protestant is interesting. And I think the reason he does it, there's many reasons. I think that one reason is because there is some institutional connection with the very idea of a New Testament, which of course comes from the church as an institution that didn't fall from heaven. But that was enough. You couldn't have any other institutional church in the gulag. But that was enough. That was enough to create something that could awaken the human soul in Ivan that had been deadened by war, materialism, and the camp. But of course, there was always Alyosha's self-sacrificial nature. It wasn't the writing in the wall that made him do these things. I mean, he was given his rations away. And then Ivan did this. He imitates them. He gives a biscuit to Alyosha, which is extremely valuable under these conditions. And it's a very severe form of deprivation. But this is the road to inner peace. And you would only know that if you suffer, if you're rejected, if you're alone. You've been kicked out of society. This has been a theme on this show and in my life and in your life in many cases, probably all your cases, from the beginning. Prison permits the spirit to show itself. But in the daily life, in our day-to-day life, if we were living some bourgeois lifestyle, it would be buried in the mundane. Now, the first circle, and these are all connected works, of course. This is a different kind of gulag. It is the gulag prison camp. The first circle is named for the more painless part of hell from Dante. And just like everything else in Solzhenitsyn, it refers to prison, technology, and our conscience, freedom. And the plot really is of no particular interest. It's really not that interesting. It's a conceptual structure here that matters. Kenti Vuloden, he makes a phone call to France. And the purpose of the phone call is to warn about a visiting doctor. He's presenting research on atomic energy to Paris, and a trap is being laid for him. Now, you can't make a phone call in the Soviet Union without it being traced. That's just inherent to it. So the KGB was waiting for this guy in Paris, and he called the French authorities to warn them about this. So he warns the French government that there's a sting operation from the NKVD and to be on alert for this. Now, the phone call itself triggers a huge network of things in the police apparatus in the Soviet Union. It's made from a public phone. So that means, and it wouldn't matter if it was, there were very few private phones, but a public phone like you would have in the street, the entire apparatus of the NKVD is alerted. He calls it a spider web of cause and effect. Stalin's at the center of the web, and it goes out to all the different branch offices of the secret police, military intelligence, and everything else. All the high-tech systems of the Soviet system are activated at the same time. So it's a Gnostic imitation of nature. It's a pseudo-organic web. But of course, it's the exact opposite. It couldn't be any less organic, and it seeks, of course, the enslavement of labor. Now, the central core here is not necessarily a phone call, but the voice recognition software that's being developed in the NKVD prison. And it's called the Mavrino Institute, which is a scientific institute within the Gulag itself. This is a part of the Gulag system where labor is in a high-tech, highly skilled field. The Gulag economy had lots of these, middle-class, well-educated prisoners who weren't treated all that badly, and they led a normal life, but they're still in prison. And the fact that they led a normal middle-class life didn't negate the fact that they were still in the Gulag. So the phone call itself, this is Solzhenitsyn's first attempt to create sort of an anti-Soviet or even anti-Enlightenment metaphysics. Not only does it activate this web of recorders and everything else throughout the security apparatus, then the voice itself is captured by the Soviet recorders and this new voice recognition technology they had just developed there. His voice is broken down into its component parts and then recreated so as to isolate its most characteristic features. Now, this is classic Enlightenment ideology. Objects are no more than the sum of their parts. This is pure nominalism. And Marx understood himself to be the fulfillment of the Enlightenment. And it kind of separated him from the anarchists. So many of them from Rousseau were very anti-Enlightenment. Many of the anarchists were anti-modern. But the Soviet vision, the Marxist vision, and Karl Marx made it very explicit that he was an incarnation of Prometheus in his early poetry. And he sought the complete manipulation, domination, control over nature. Nature was to become literally human, and therefore at the function of the command of the party. And nature would obey the commands of the party no different than our fingers or arms would obey our will. But the Promethean myth was explicit in the USSR. Because people forget that when you're talking about fixing nature, controlling nature, well, man is a part of nature. Man is a part of nature. It's an integral part of it. So it's a double talk. I mean, usually you think of nature, you think of these things external to us. But when we talk about the control of nature for the benefit of mankind, or some abstraction like that, well, our own lives are a part of this nature too. So that means controlling us. See, when Trotsky used the word nature, you can never take these guys at their word. One of the major theses of the book that I have coming out is how these guys use words like worker, kulak, proletariat, revolutionary, bourgeois. They use these words in a Janus kind of a way. They use them in an esoteric way. So when Trotsky used the word nature in many contexts, he was referring to the peasants, as he called the ignorant dark masses. He absolutely hated them. He needed them regimented in a factory system to be imposed on the farm. So it's mechanistic farming rather than organic farming. So just as the voice recognition system creates a catalog of human voices who are breaking down its vibrations, Solzhenitsyn is breaking down this Promethean mythology of the Enlightenment and the USSR, claiming it's its final manifestation. Now, of course, modern capitalism is saying it's its final manifestation. But breaking down of something, that any object can be understood by tearing it apart, understanding each part and putting it back together again. And that's all the object is. It's just the sum of its parts, which of course isn't true. Because it assumes that then what anything is, including ourselves, is just a bunch of atoms that you could take apart and study separately and put back together again. Remember, Karl Marx's doctoral dissertation was on the atomists, Democritus of Athens. It was on materialism as a metaphysic. Man is nothing more than a set of atoms that in some random way create a personality. Therefore, the NKVD's voice recognition system is a part of this science as a means of total control. And the human voice, of course, being treated this way is distinct from its personality. It's nothing more than a set of vibrations, rather than as what it really is, embedded in real personality and moral conscience. So technology here is stripped of any kind of liberating property. It is nothing more than a servant of the state. The first circle is also about the institute itself. And it's hard to imagine that you have a gulag system, and it did exist, of course, with, you know, high-class, well-educated scientists living a middle-class life within the regime, working on just this kind of technology. And it's kind of a bizarre thing that these two ideas can be combined. We think of the gulag, we think of people out in the snow and missing limbs and everything else. But these men are treated very well. They're an integral part of the regime. Now, at the Marino Institute, there are a few different types. The first is the party hack, Reuben, who's obviously Jewish. And the main character, really, Nazinin, who was a dissident but an idealist. Reuben is a scientist ordered by Stalin personally to analyze the tape record of the spy apparatus that ends up getting Volodin arrested. Once this phone call is made to France, everyone's alerted. Stalin himself is aware of it. Reuben had been an NKVD spy during the war and was promised good treatment in exchange for loyalty while at the camp. He was put in prison after the war for one reason. It's because he refused to put in practice Stalin's order to kill OPOWs. That's what got his ticket to the camp. But because he was a scientist, he was sent to Marino. And he knew Volodin. He liked him very much. He's a very typical character. You see this in all these great dissident writers. His conscience is externalized. It's not something he takes responsibility for. As Jean-Paul Sartre would call it, it's bad faith, or Das Man in Heidegger. It's not him. He externalized it, in this case, into the party, or even Stalin himself. The party was the truth. The party was the working class. When Lenin or Trotsky referred to labor, or the worker, or the proletariat, he wasn't referring to a guy in a factory with a wrench. He was referring to party members and party supporters. As I've said many times, Trotsky saw Armand Hammer, a multi-billionaire, as a proletarian and a worker. So obviously he doesn't mean it in the sense that we normally mean. One of the core ideas of this dissident metaphysics is this externalization of our conscience. And it shows up again and again and again throughout Solzhenitsyn and many other people. It's the removal of moral judgment from us as people and externalizing it onto something else. An ideology, a person, whatever, a state. Someone like Reuben, the party, is the embodiment of science. It's its final expression. It's also the same thing that sent him to jail, but that doesn't bother him. He follows orders without question because the party is greater than he is, and it doesn't matter that it put him in prison. Because it represents Marx, and Marx had the key to world history and also scientific progress. Someone like Rubin, everything is material. There's no conscience outside of science anyway. It's unclear why he refuses to kill these guys. With German POWs, he refuses to slaughter them. Obviously, he doesn't fully believe this. The party's kind of the exoskeleton that holds the chaos of Soviet atoms together. Atoms in the brain, within the body, within society. So the party is a skeleton of the new Soviet man. The manifestations we referred to in this show before as the Adam Kadmon, the archetypal man of the Kabbalah. So Nijinin, upbraids Rubin. He talks about his inconsistency, and he says that somehow the state is exempt from moral laws that we impose on others. That we as individuals can't do something, but the state can. And Solzhenitsyn, in his own personal writing elsewhere, spent a lot of time on this issue. That the state, the party, should be subject to morality just like anybody else, as any person. And it can be judged by the same criteria. So Nijinin represents the concept of man that's not reducible to material things. Like a voice reducible to the vibrations, or the brain reducible to atoms. But if that's true, then freedom is possible. And it doesn't matter, like everything else, your physical surroundings have no relevance here. Because our conscience is spiritual and therefore free, it's inviolable. It can't be externalized. Anyone who seeks to externalize it is doing it out of bad faith. And of everybody in that prison, Nijinin is the most poorly treated. But he is also the happiest. Happiness doesn't depend on physical circumstances. It depends on the watchfulness, the guarding of the soul. Freedom exists only because it's material, by definition, immaterial. Freedom is by definition something that isn't material. Because if it's material, one of the definitions of a material object is that it's based in the web of cause and effect that everything in creation is based on. But because the soul is not material, it can't be controlled by the state, or by science, or by capital. And we see this over and over again with all these writers. Freedom is happiness. And happiness can only be only come into itself when the soul remains autonomous. That is to say, not distorted by any external elements. But Rubin denies the soul entirely. He doesn't really deny it, he externalizes it. And he places it in the hands of the party, which makes it worse. It's this externalization that made the tyranny of the USSR possible. Nijinin has offered his freedom and he refuses. He says, I'm only free in prison. I'm only free in Siberia. If I were released and if I went out into the day-to-day world, I would be crushed. Because just like any American, you have family issues and bills to pay and kids and neighbors and reputation and bank accounts and everything else, debt that keeps us up at night. And in prison, it's far simpler. It's not as pleasant, but I'm happier. Now, the Institute might be able to create comfort, but it can't create happiness. He's a slave no matter how he's treated. He's just a cog in a wheel. These men, generally speaking, are treated very, very well. They're very important to the state, but they're still prisoners. They're still slaves. He was offered a job as a full-time cryptographer. But in that job, he would be directly responsible to the party, and hence Stalin, so he says no. He's free in prison because at least there he's always a dissident. In the USSR, the harshest prisons are the only place that someone can be free and happy. This is the only place that you can actually live in opposition to the regime. In other words, the external world uses the term freedom to describe itself, but it's no such thing. like in Ivan Denisovich, you do have beatings, starvation rations, and some, you know, in Siberia with in Ivan Denisovich, the constant reminder that, that only there the soul can be left alone. He's imprisoned exactly because he rejects the ideal of the party. He will not externalize his will. That's the central issue here. So there are 9 elements here. I want to go through these very quickly. It's how I summarize the first circle and much of Solzhenitsyn's psychology. Number 1. Happiness can be found anywhere except the day-to-day grind of the modern world, what we would call the bourgeois order of self-interest. Because it makes our happiness dependent on external things like money or markets or reputation. He rejects Western utilitarianism entirely. He turns it on its head. Because the soul is dependent on these external things, it can never be happy. Because the soul is dependent on these external things, it becomes material itself. Second thing. There's an immediate connection between the state and the enlightenment, as I've said before. Its world is based entirely on material things. And science, of course, is used to control the external world, and then it seeks to then predict from its models what can happen. So, for example, it assumes that men desire money. This is something good to them. So if we want to control antisocial behavior, we will charge fines. The fine will be painful because this is what everyone wants, money. So the higher the fine, the better the chance they're going to stop doing whatever it is that we are fining. Which, of course, is based on the axiomatic claim that men want money and this is what they care about. And it's terribly painful not to have it. Therefore, we use fines, jail terms, whatever it might be. This is the old Victorian morality based on utility, the pursuit of pleasure. It's the foundation of the free market. The third thing. This is a web. The Enlightenment is a web of external stimuli. We're only talking about atoms in the void here. Therefore, it's totalitarian. If the force applied in one direction affects everything, then everything is connected. In the very beginning of the novel, Volodin's voice creates this chain reaction. The minute he's on the phone and he's talking about this stuff, that the network is activated. Phones ring all over the place. Automated recorders should go off. It's a dystopian regime. Everything is connected. Number 4. Zenon is the hero here. He's a humanist in the best sense of the term. He's not motivated by any ideology or any externalized conscience. He questions, he suffers, he searches, but he's always cheerful because he recognizes that happiness and autonomy are one and the same. The worst thing is to identify a society with a set of concepts, some ideological apparatus. Number 5, there's a janitor here, Spiridon Yegorov. It's the same situation. He was in the Civil War. He fought on both the red and the white side. And no matter which side won, he's going to go to prison because he fought for both. It was a very complicated situation. He's barely literate. But because he's been in this prison for a long time, he comes to the same conclusion as Nurzinin does. Happiness is based in rejection of externalization of your conscience. You can't base your well-being on some other external thing, but the state or the market or your job, whatever it might be. In having fought for both sides, it's a symbolic way of saying that the man's experienced everything. He knows all sides of the story. Sadness, real depression, is possible mainly in the highest and most exalted positions. 6, material progress is not related to happiness. Progress has nothing to do with scientific development. Now, that alone is the most revolutionary thing that you could say, whether it be in capitalist West or in the Soviet Union. Not only that, it's in fact a barrier to happiness. The more production develops, the economy gets more and more complex, the more society comes to identify with its progressive nature, and that soon distorts the moral intuition of everybody. Because it creates the moral axiom that the more one has, the happier you'll be. Number 7. You see this all over Russian literature. Siberia is a symbol of freedom. It's a symbol of freedom because prison is the only place where you can escape the Enlightenment, where you can escape the notion that reputation or possession or place or party rank, whatever it is identical with happiness. And pursuing that is the rational way to live. But if everything is material, that means everything is amenable to scientific control. If the state is based on the scientific control, then by definition the state itself has to be totalitarian. The concept of totalism means that every aspect of life, at least in theory, can be regulated by the law. Now, almost all modern societies have this. There is no aspect of our world, the United States or Great Britain today, that is not that isn't regulated by the state. Almost every word we say now is. If everything can be regulated by the state, and the personal is the political, and there is no private realm, then the system has to be totalitarian. If you start off at the assumption that science has a right to control everything that's material, and then you say that materialism is all that there is, by definition, you've just said that the only rational order is a totalitarian one. Because by its own self-definition, science is in charge of placing order in the chaos of the world. The world is everything. Utilitarianism, therefore, is totalitarianism. Therefore, because of that, prison is freedom, because it implies rejection and resistance. Number 8, this two-faced nature of modernity, and one of the more depressing and the dark humor of this novel. He's taken to Siberian prison in a truck. And because so many prisoners were being sent, they didn't want these big prison buses to alert the population. The trucks that they used to transport prisoners were disguised as meat deliveries, which has numerous symbolic purposes. So it was disguised as a food truck delivering meat to local groceries. So a French journalist, the alleged specialist on the Soviet system, is on the streets of Moscow, and he writes story after story to the Western press saying the extraordinary plenty to be found in the USSR, because he's seen so many meat trucks since he's been in Moscow. They must have so much food, and the markets are packed with things. One meat truck after another. What an extraordinary society. Now, this is very dark humor, but he's mocking what we've been talking about here, the pathetic media, the pathetic scientific establishment and ideological establishment that accepted pretty much anything the Soviet Union said because it wanted to. Finally, 9, the pure soul is happiness. Solzhenitsyn was a Kantian in this regard. Kant's vision of autonomy is that any material external distortion that affects our moral choice destroys it. And what I mean is, material distortion would be any kind of self-interest, any coercion. It could be a passion, you know, a drive to do something, or it can be an external violence, or just pure self-interest, or conforming to an ideology, whatever it is. If our choice is based on anything like that, it is not free and hence not moral. The moral law exists precisely in that it is not dependent on these external things. It exists in itself and is self-defined. Now, even though this comes straight out of Kant, it's nothing new. It's the essence of the ascetic mentality, that our way of thought can't be based on any passion, any external conformity. It's based on itself. It's based on its own autonomy. But to be free that way is extremely radical. You can't be motivated by passions, would be anger or hunger or anything like that. The minute it is, it destroys it. Because the minute you start pursuing self-interest like this, you then project that desire onto the world. And over time, you become as delusional as everybody else. The pure soul is an autonomous one. And one of Kant's great achievements is to spell out the difference between autonomy and freedom. Autonomy is a will that is not subject to any coercion, whether internally or externally. That means happiness and moral action is possible anywhere. You see this throughout Solzhenitsyn. Now, the cancer ward, Solzhenitsyn did have, can you imagine being in the gulag and also getting cancer? And being sent to Kazakhstan for treatment. And he beats it. Rusanov in the cancer ward is the Rubin here. They're really identical characters, the same idea. This conformist mentality, destroying your own free will by placing trust in external objects. The party, the state. Rusanov is actually worse than Rubin because he's just a servile informer. And he's talking about the Soviet Union, of course, here, but you know, it's the Enlightenment in general that he's attacking. The Soviet Union is just a particularly obnoxious version of it. You know, we have scientific production that's been created extraordinary things, but when you demand more out of nature than it's willing to give in and of itself, which of course all modernity is based on, you have to sacrifice something. So when you talk about, for example, an automobile, we enjoy driving, it's a certain freedom there, but you consider the grid, the massive sacrifice that trillions of dollars has been spent, the huge amount of fuel, the asphalt, this massive grid, the tolls and taxes and mangled bodies and deaths. Also, it's easier for us to get to the store. Any one of these progressive developments has human sacrifice as an element of it. But both the capitalist West and the Soviet Union base itself on just this concept of progress. And you have to say that the sacrifice is worth it. Just like in the first circle, it's a web. Everything is connected here. You can't talk about something like a cell phone or the internet without making reference to this massive, interconnected, global web of power that has to be financed and maintained at great cost and usually a great loss of life. Rusanov is a professional informer, and what he does is when he wants something, a house or a woman that he likes, he'll go to the local party boss and say that her husband has been reading a, you know, talking to a CIA agent, you know, or MI6 agent, or been reading a Bible or something like that. And the guy goes off and gets questioned and no one ever sees him again. And then Rusanov goes and comforts the widow. He has a nightmare and he's sleeping, and the nightmare, he's crawling through a pipe of some kind. At the end of the pipe, he sees a small girl, which is the daughter of a man that Rusanov had placed in prison. And he invented all these crazy charges because he wanted a better apartment. And he became pretty famous. Rusanov became, everyone knew him for this. And he had enough actual real crimes that he reported that he had to be believed. Now, the point of this dream, and it really bothers him, he keeps seeing this girl, the daughter of a guy that he had sent to the gulag because he wanted his apartment. But why does he have this nightmare? For the same reason that Rubin and the First Circle wouldn't kill the German POWs. Because I don't care how long they conform, how long they externalize their conscience. There is this spark that can't go away. Natural law can't be stamped out entirely. His conscience still exists. Now, I'm not talking about a real psychological condition like sociopathy. A sociopath is someone without a conscience. Because even the most hardcore narcissist has a conscience, however buried it might be. In fact, the suffering of a narcissist is that he has a conscience and he realizes he's not what he says he is. But you know, the hospital here, in this story, is not unlike the prison. Because the same system that informs the gulag informs the scientific establishment in the hospital, for better or for worse. And one of the discussions here is Rusanov is talking to Poduov, who's an old believer. Remember, this is in Kazakhstan. And they're debating the idea of spontaneous or miracle healing. And Poduov says that the soul can heal itself because asceticism, under a strict regimen of asceticism, can cure most diseases. Because in controlled, very strict fasting, the first thing that the body does is consume tumors and junk stuff, disease, scar tissue and everything else internally that it doesn't need. This is why fasting is so pure, purifying. The body's not going to consume healthy tissue. It's going to consume unhealthy tissue. It's going to take all these little tumors and cysts and everything that you have, acne, it's going to consume that first. The definition of starvation is when your system starts consuming healthy tissue. That's the bad part. That's not what fasting is about. Now, that's the secular idea of fasting. The spiritual idea of fasting, though, is connected to it, because either, two sides of the same coin. It opens the senses. It permits greater insight, deeper concentration. This is why we fast. It does for others what the prison or the cancer ward does for characters here. Going to the gulag for Solzhenitsyn is not that much different than being told you have cancer. And God forbid any of my listeners ever get that news. A purity of life is connected to our health. It's the secular reason why all of the ancient religions, Orthodoxy, Islam, practice fasting, even philosophical systems, in Athens or in amongst the Buddhists. The point of it here is to raise the human brain into the mind, into the soul, and go above cause and effect. To depart this kind of world and to be able to see the ultimate spiritual core of the world can be apprehended. And then over time, if this is a world you live in, you begin living in a very different world. The Church Fathers always had the slogan, the Holy Spirit can't be perceived on a full stomach. The mind's eye has to be heightened by the action of ritual, strict regimen of fasting, and both manual and intellectual labor. Which, when you come to think of it, isn't all that different from the gulag. Rubin and Mursanov are believers in ideology, dogma. I'm not talking about doctrine here. A dogma in the worst sense of the term. That somehow reality can be reduced to written manifestos or pamphlets. This is mass society. This is a cardinal sin of mass ideology. In both these stories, Rubin, Rusanov, they're used to express the extreme conclusion to all rationalistic approaches to the world, to progress. These guys all speak in cliches and slogan, that they take them right out of their party handbook, and they think this is somehow their knowledge. And we see this with, academics and journalists. Everything they say is a set of hackneyed cliches that over time they truly believe are theirs. And you go in a university as a professor, or the New York Times as a writer, and you say something even a little bit different from whether it be the feminist narrative or the globalist narrative, you're in a lot of trouble. But because these jobs are very good jobs, because these jobs are sought after, because they're getting fewer and fewer and fewer, people are becoming more and more fanatical about keeping them. And so, this is the birth of virtue signaling. What that means is,
somebody signals to a powerful person that they're harmless. So a young professor gets a job. He's looking for tenure in 6 years. So if he's a white male, he has to be the most radical guy out there. He has to put all this feminist stuff on his door and preach it and punish students for not going along with it. Make himself so radical that he can't be tied to any kind of thought crime, which happens all the time. Then he's certified as reasonable and dependable. But in the cancer ward, these catechetical answers, and you know, they're two different types. One type are people who just don't know any better. This is all they know. They're either too stupid or they were born into it. But then there's others. They're the educated, you know, bureaucrats and philosophers and politicians. They actually know better. But because they have such a great gig, they need to conform themselves to it. This is essential in any, you know, really any institution, and it's getting worse, and this is the connection of, this is what modernity is. It's not an accident that in the Middle Ages, you had an almost complete lack of bureaucracy. Even the Byzantine Empire, even the Papal Curia. Compared to the modern state, these were anarchist institutions. Noble families. The guild, the urban labor union. This is what carried out policy. So you didn't have a centralized state in any sense of the term. So liberalism, capitalism, let alone Marxism, they're creations of state power, and they're in conjunction with elite interests. So Solzhenitsyn asks a common sense question about technology. So those with money commission technological innovation. They'll do what's in their interest to do. This can be the state, private capital, semi-private capital, like tech companies. The science can't think objectively because they're working for somebody. A scientist has to know where his grant money is coming from or he's in trouble. These are self-interested actors. They're not autonomous in the sense we were just talking about. And it doesn't make any difference what that elite is. It's all the same thing. Solzhenitsyn is making a connection between party thinking and the Enlightenment, conformism, technology, and freedom. He's telling us that freedom needs to be redefined in the sense of autonomy, that this omni-state is not going away because the way that the state functions in the broad sense is through mobilizing interest groups. Every aspect of the state has a powerful interest group attached to it, whether welfare or Medicaid, military. There's large numbers of people who benefit from it and therefore are willing to fight for it. In fact, I've made the argument a long time ago that modern politics is nothing other than these powerful interest groups bargaining amongst themselves for greater or lesser slices of the pie. So the state provides favors. The group that's given the favors provides loyalty, which makes freedom and actual citizenship impossible. Prison and death are the two elements that manifest freedom here. But that's an extreme thing, but only in sick societies is that the case. When you're in a cancer ward and you're looking death in the face, it's no different than going off to the gulag. You have to look at yourself objectively. All of a sudden, you don't give a damn what people think about you. You don't care about the corporate ladder anymore. You go to the gulag, you get cancer, it's the same thing. Outside, it's the other that's the prison. But when you're in prison, compromise isn't necessary. You don't give a damn about ideology when you get cancer. So someone like Nijinin would rather be deported to Siberia than go and work for the NKVD, even though he would have a great salary and everything else. The temptation, I mean, if I were given this great job as an academic, would I maintain my integrity? Or would I be so taken up in the money and the prestige that I would slowly but surely begin making compromises? Would I do that? Therefore, is going to prison in one sense or another something that God does to help us? So these worlds Solzhenitsyn has created here, modern society at large, with the socialist or the bourgeois system in the West, the prison, the hospital, or political leadership itself. They differ in form, but not in content. They use coercion, but not usually open coercion. People are self-censoring. So freedom of conscience, in a non-cliché way, is a rare gift. Well, I've come to the end of my time here, and I've only gotten to about half of what I wanted to get done. So this is going to be a two-parter. So this has been part one of Solzhenitsyn's very brief summary of his philosophical idea, using a few works of his to get to the root of this. And thank you for listening. We'll finish up next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.